Sushi.
Nunca fuimos de viaje a Japón.
This event is also sponsored by Colectivo Ruda and Hub Hub Creative. Again.
La mula no era arisca, pero la hicieron.
That's Unity, a night of feminist Latinx PDX hip hop, Tuesday, August 28th at 9 p.m. at the Duffer Lounge, 830 E Burnside Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
KBU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. This Planned Parenthood fundraiser will screen A Girl Like Her, which tells the hidden history of over a million young women who became pregnant in the 1950s and 60s and were banished to maternity homes to give birth and surrender their babies for adoption. And Jane, an Abortion Service, a documentary of Jane. The Chicago-based women's health group performed nearly 12,000 safe illegal abortions between 1969 and 1973. There will be a conversation after the films between a former Jane, Judith Arcana, and a girl like her, Lonnie Jo Lee. Again, that's the Feminist Film Night and Planned Parenthood fundraiser on Friday, August 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Making Contact, taking a look at the history of Hawaii. At 9:30, it's Got Science from the Union of Concerned Scientists with a discussion about how to keep the power on during a climate crisis. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, the Dirtbag welcomes your calls to talk about a new technique or something else new you tried in your garden this year. And now, Making Contact.
This week on Making Contact.
Development needs to be controlled. Development can only take place if it's going to benefit the local people. You can't keep developing everything because then you're going to pave over paradise.
Some call it paradise, but Hawaii isn't just a tourist getaway. Look beyond the resorts, and you'll find a history of opposition to U.S. occupation. From sacred sites to indigenous language, Hawaiians are fighting hard to protect their traditions and their future.
We're not a people that are looking and striving to become a recognized nation, as much as a people that is trying to have our sovereignty or our independence be re-recognized.
On this edition, we hear how Hawaii came under U.S. control, and why some Native Hawaiians want to see it become independent once more. I'm Nancy Lopez, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Hawaii became the 50th state in 1959, but the question of independence has never gone away. In a 2012 film by Catherine Bach Knight called Hawaii, A Voice for Sovereignty, she explores the history of Hawaii, from the beginning of the U.S. occupation to the present day. The film starts by looking at the all-important issue of sovereignty and what this word means to Hawaiians.
The native Hawaiians, the Kanaka Maoli, traveled through vast oceans thousands of years ago to the islands of Hawaii. The air, the water, the land was considered their extended family. They did not separate themselves from the natural world, and still today, the land, their culture, and their spirituality are deeply connected. The Kanaka Maoli are a people who have exercised their sovereign rights for many centuries. This freedom has been challenged since the United States takeover by political, economic, and military oppression. They have remained silent for over 100 years, but now they are speaking out.
Each of us are taking different paths, whether it be through hula, through the restoration of the lo'i for our taro, political sovereignty, financial means, health reform. Whatever the case may be, there are many leaders out there now stepping forward. Hawaiians will refuse to be prisoners of war.
To understand why many Native Hawaiians feel that way, even now, the film takes us back to where and how it all began. Here, Dennis Bumpy Kanahele, a political activist in Oahu.
Prior to the arrival of the first Europeans in 1778, the Native Hawaiian people lived in a highly organized, self-sufficient, subsistent social system based on communal land tenure with a sophisticated language, culture, and religion. That is the findings and fact by Congress, by the United States of America.
Britain and France, in the Anglo-Franco Proclamation of November 20, 1843, recognized the independent nation-state of the Hawaiian Kingdom.
That was Kalekola Kaeo, a professor of Hawaiian studies at Maui Community College.
We were recognized before Turkey, before Argentina, before China, before Japan, before many of the African nations were recognized as being part of what we call the family of nations.
The native Hawaiians, the Kanaka Maoli, believed that land could not be owned. For centuries, they were caretakers. But sugarcane and pineapple were becoming a significant part of the Hawaiian economy. The Kanaka agreed to let the corporations borrow their land, believing the promises that the land would be returned to them.
They were the people that had overthrown the kingdom of Hawaii, was the plantation people, the sugarcane plantation people. They would just plant their cane on the land and say that it's theirs. And then they would come up with these titles and they would make these titles and they would say that this is theirs. And in order to make it legitimate in an American way, in American system, is they had the money to pay for it. And the Hawaiians didn't have the money to pay for it.
That was Guy Aina, a fisherman from Hana. When European explorers arrived in 1778, the native Hawaiian population was 800,000. During the United States takeover, a century later, the population had been slashed to 40,000.
Now, really what happens on January 16, 1893, it's important to remember in Hawaii's history that 187 U.S. Marines off the USS Boston were landed in Honolulu and took up position across of the Iolani Palace. And their main purpose was to protect the interests of those who call themselves the Committee of Safety, which were really American citizens and missionary descendants who were bent upon taking political control away from the Hawaiian people.
Queen Liliuokalani was removed from the throne by US armed forces. In her place, Sanford B. Dole was proclaimed the president of Hawaii.
Dole and his bandits self-proclaimed himself to become what's called the provisional government. And with the help of the U.S. Marines, by armed force, begin the U.S. occupation of these islands. And as was stated by the president of that time in 1893, President Cleveland from the U.S., who described this act, and in fact, he called it an act of war. These are the words of the U.S. president himself to define what the U.S. Marines did upon that day. Now, it's important to understand that because since that time, we've been under occupation. Our country has been under illegal occupation since 1893. The U.S. Marines landed, and we still haven't left. And so on January 17th, 1893, the Queen of Hawaii protested what went on. And she basically says, I yield to the superior forces of the United States of America.
I, Liliuokalani, by the grace of God, and under the Constitution of the Hawaiian Kingdom, do hereby solemnly protest against any and all acts done against myself and the constitutional
that
government.
I yield to the superior force of the United States of America
troops to be landed at Honolulu. I do this under protest and impelled by said force, yield my authority until such time as the government of the United States shall, upon facts being presented to it, undo the action of its representatives and reinstate me in the authority which I claim as the constitutional sovereign of the Hawaiian Islands.
2 years after the Queen was removed from the throne, a group of supporters was arrested during a failed rebellion. Although the Queen knew nothing of these plans, she was charged with treason. For 8 months, she was imprisoned in one room of the palace in solitary confinement. It was there that she composed many songs, including the Queen's Prayer. The beloved Queen of Hawaii died in 1917 at age 79.
It's clear to understand, it's a very important point to understand. There is no treaty of annexation between the Hawaiian Islands and the Hawaiian Kingdom and the U.S. Senate. In fact, the U.S. Senate voted against accepting the treaty. The Hawaiians come forward with a petition drive, and 39,000 signatures of Hawaiians, my ancestors, 39,000, over 95% of our people at that time, signed this petition, protesting that action, in fact, declaring that they did not want to be part of the United States, and in fact, we declared ourselves to be independent. In 1898, President McKinley realized that he could not pass this treaty through the U.S. Senate. Instead, he passed a joint resolution, which purported that gave this idea that they were intending to annex the Hawaiian Islands in the future. With this joint resolution, the United States began this process of increasing the amount of military presence in Hawaiian Islands. And then this kind of facade built over the years, which they still haven't come forward to get the consent of the subjects of the Hawaiian Kingdom. And this facade has lived on for far too long. And this is really the cornerstone of what you see going on to this day. The United States still haven't provided how they gain jurisdiction of these islands, how they gain title to these islands. How do they gain the consent of our people? And this, again, is a crux to what you see going on to this day throughout the Hawaiian Islands.
Flow from his throne, unto his home, his
atom. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to excerpts of Hawaii, A Voice for Sovereignty. In recent years, Hawaiians have begun to confront their past. Up next, we'll hear about their current struggles to claim ownership of the land, of their culture, and of their livelihood. Here again, Dennis Bumpy Kanahele, the political activist from Oahu.
We're just learning about what we lost. And so the reconnect with our land, with our spirituality, as strong as it is, the problem today is that the land has been stolen, taken away, somehow disconnected with the people.
There are many questions pertaining to the land holdings of Hawaii. Questions such as who holds the land titles, the rights, the claims, through land commission awards, warranty deeds, native tenant claims, quiet title through adverse possession, tax map keys, and royal patents.
We're looking at this right now.
That's Kenneth Ho'opai Jr., a minister in Maui. He's flipping through a large white book with the title Grants and Patents on the cover. It's full of names.
In this is book of all the islands, and in this book there's royal patents, lands, and not just that, but names of families. Families who have claims to these lands. These land patents still exist. There was never a transfer of jurisdiction from our nation or our government over to theirs, you see? So the laws of the land, the kingdom laws, still exist.
The way the developers and the plantation owners now claim they own the lands is through what's called adverse possession.
This is attorney Richard McCarty, who explains how developers and plantation owners continue to lay claim to the land.
So even though the families had allowed the plantation to use the lands, now the plantations are showing up and saying, now that use was adverse to your interests, so you don't own your land anymore. And the Hawaiians go into court when they're noticed in for these kind of lawsuits, and they're thinking that they can go in and just be honest, be forthright, as they always are, and say, and they hope the judge will do the fair thing and say, wait, you're a scoundrel, plantation, you don't own this land, you've stolen it. But instead, the courts are saying, you own the land because of this trickery in the law.
In an ongoing battle over land rights, Native Hawaiians like Jocelyn Costa are often forced off the land by developers and police who accuse them of trespassing. Land developers are sometimes able to purchase property that Hawaiians claim is royal patent land. With their economic power and political influence, these developers are able to overcome the objections and protests of the native landholders. According to the Kanaka Maoli, projects like a recent large residential development are given approval by land use authorities who don't legally recognize the patents.
Again, attorney Richard McCarty.
At one point, I met a group of families that live in the Kaula Valley, and it's a valley that's above the town of Lahaina in West Maui, and they were having many problems relating to development pushing into areas that have been their homes for many, many generations. The family of Keomoku Kapu and his wife Ui and his four children were confronted with developers who showed up with a large bulldozer and were going to threaten sites that needed preservation by the state preservation division. That morning, the family had to go out bare-chested with spears and confront a bulldozer. And when they left their home, they formed a group and said, today is a good day to die if necessary. We will stand, we will protect these lands, and we will hold them at any cost, including our lives if necessary.
Politics has really dictated our life, and it doesn't give us not even a fair opportunity to say anything based upon all the problems that we're going through right now. And you know,
that's Keomoku Kapu, a youth cultural instructor who was fighting for his lands.
And you know, if everybody thinks that you know we're living a happy life up here, hey, guess again. Every day is a different day for us. And tomorrow may be a new day where we might end up in court for something else.
Here again, Guy Aina, a fisherman from Hana.
We don't need another Kmart, not in Hana. We don't need another rich development with all these million-dollar houses that's called some kind of heights, like Hamoa Heights or something like that. We don't need that. Development needs to be controlled. Development can only take place if it's going to benefit the local people. You can't keep developing everything because then you're going to pave over paradise. And you know, that's the reason why a lot of people come to Hawaii, is for the beauty of it. But if you're gonna keep building on it and covering everything all up with houses, that's not gonna be good. That's not what people came here for. That's not what we want.
From the time plantations started growing pineapples and sugarcane in the 1800s to the development of modern luxury resorts, water has been increasingly diverted away from the Kanaka Mo'olelei.
These lands here, which is known as crown lands, ceded lands, lands for the alii.
That's Edward Wendt, a taro farmer in East Maui. Taro is a staple crop in the Pacific that has fed Hawaiians for centuries.
The state has leased these lands out to corporations, sugar companies, pineapple, and also water is given to upcountry domestic purposes. The state has allowed East Maui irrigation to collect over 60 billion gallons of water a year for a fifth of a penny per thousand gallons, and has allowed East Maui Irrigation and Alexander and Baldwin to continue this practice for over 130 years. The dewatering of the streams has a great impact on our fragile environment, and yet the state has allowed them to dewater to have a great impact on our traditional, customary way of life.
Taro is more than just a source of food for the Hawaiians. It is a spiritual connection between the land and the native people. Water is being diverted away from the taro fields, threatening this precious resource.
They're diverting the water to the hotels and not using the water for the kuleana rites. The water should be diverted to the river.
And this is Auntie Susan Lord, a royal patent landholder.
We need our water for our agriculture, for the taro, and we need it for the family, you know, what we're used to. We're used to having kuleana water coming through our land in Papahawaii and being able to have taro patches. We're not able to have taro patches because there's not enough water.
Taro now is becoming a piece of history in Hawaii. It is said that what happens to Haloa, what happens to the fields of taro throughout Hawaii, will give us an indication of what happens to Lapo'e Hawaii, the people of Hawaii.
That was Clifford Naeole, a cultural advisor for the Ritz-Carlton Kapalua.
During the building of a major resort on Maui, Native Hawaiian bones were uncovered in an ancient burial site. Construction was halted and a decision had to be made. Should the bones be moved? Should construction continue? Or was there another option? This was a sensitive and significant issue for both the Hawaiians and the resort developers. So a meeting was arranged between the developers, government officials, and Native elders.
For 20 hours, all parties involved negotiated, and the developers reneged. They would move the construction of the Ritz-Carlton 500 feet back, and they would preserve the burial site. For Hawaiians, it became the first resort in Hawaii to say sanctity and dignity first. The ancestral bones were reinterred during a sacred ceremony.
Many Kanaka Mo'olelei are working in different ways for the people and their sovereignty. Some work with social issues or education, the environment or housing. Some are willing to protest against injustices. And others want to have an active debate through forums such as a Hawaiian Constitutional Convention, where delegates can freely discuss issues such as Native Hawaiian government, banking, and their economy. Others suggest responsible ways to bridge knowledge of the past with modern technologies to develop sustainable resources.
We go back to the village of creating the farming, the fishing, and using indigenous architecture as much as we can for the housing.
This is Woody Vaspra of the World Council of Elders.
There's also opportunities for ocean power and also create up systems like micro-utilities, where if one makes enough, it can be shared among other folks.
I'm Richard Ha. I farm here on the Big Island. We have about 600 acres. Part of it is in bananas, and a good portion of it is in hydroponic vegetables. We really need to try as hard as we can to sustain ourselves with what we have here. Energy security is on everybody's mind, renewable energy sources. But something more important than that is food security. Maybe we need to broaden our approach to food. And the question that comes up is, what about protein? We could do tilapia because it's a vegetarian fish. And if we integrated it into our greenhouse operation where we fed them waste from our food production, they convert it to ammonia. The ammonia goes back with the water into our reservoir, which we then pump back into the hydroponic tomatoes. So we then get a reuse of the resource that we have available, as well as grow protein.
There is a growing interest in the fate of the Hawaiian culture. It's becoming increasingly apparent that what happens to indigenous cultures may be an indicator of what happens to all of us.
This is Lono, music professor and musician.
A lot of things are slipping away. Our kids are being distracted with, you know, American Idol and all this stuff that is fake, that will not be there for them later. Hawaiian culture, its style and its language, its Hawaiian music, will be there for you later in your life.
This is Kili Nama'u, a preschool director.
In the late 1800s, the Hawaiian people, 98% of the people were literate. One of the best ways to, I guess, subdue a culture was to eliminate their language. And it was abolished, it was against the law, to teach Hawaiian in the school.
The University of Hawaii and a lot of people speak the regular Hawaiian language. I speak the old Hawaiian.
This is Auntie Agi Kanakele, a retired school teacher from Oahu.
I speak the old Hawaiian, which a lot of the people don't understand me because I speak the old Hawaiian, not the everyday that they learn at the University of Hawaii at community college, different schools. So when they speak to me, I just look at them. And I went, "Ho'olohe ika pepea," which means listen. And they listen, and I speak in my old Hawaiian language, and they stare at me. "Auntie, what did you say?" I said, "Hupo malino," which means, "You so lolo."
This is Jay Kalani English, the Hawaiian state senator.
Without Hawaiian as a living language, our entire worldview changes, and we become what we fear the most. We become like any other state in the Union. We are still Polynesian, we're still part of the Pacific, we still retain many of the Polynesian traits of, you know, aloha and compassion and love for one another. And as long as the host culture survives, that will be so in Hawaii. The minute the Hawaiian culture is stifled, we become American, we become like any other state, and all is lost.
So
So what is the lesson for us today? Well, the lesson for us today is that when we get involved in politics today, especially with struggles over the protection of land or natural resources, the protection of our burials, the protection of our rights to access and gather these areas, the protection of the right of the streams to flow into the ocean, the protection of the resources from the ocean to provide sustenance and to sustain ourselves. These are all struggles regarding the land itself. These are all political. These are all based upon our concept of sovereignty. Our sovereignty is not determined by a passport or a constitution, but our sovereignty is again determined by the essence of who we are as a people. That as long as we live on as a people, the essence of who we are, our language, our arts, our dances, our histories, that we live on as a people, that we will continue to struggle and fight. And we are alive. If we continue to struggle, that we make progress, then we are alive.
That was Kalei Kolakaeo, a professor of Hawaiian Studies at Maui Community College. And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to excerpts from Hawaii, A Voice for Sovereignty by Catherine Bachknight. For more information, go to hawaiiavoiceforsovereignty.com. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Nancy Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
You're listening to KBOO. Thanks for tuning in and listening to Making Contact. Up next at 9:30, it's Got Science from the Union of Concerned Scientists with a discussion about how to keep the power on during a climate crisis. All right, stay tuned. Up next is Got Science.
Welcome to the Got Science podcast. I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Well, we're sticking with our summer theme, extreme heat, heat waves, melting Alaska, and today, the strain on the power grid. And stick around after the interview for some good news. Cynthia Duraco is back with the third installment of Science for the Win. What are your summer essentials? A good book? Popsicles? Sunglasses? What about electricity? If you're like me, you've spent the summer giving thanks for air-conditioned spaces. And if you're really like me, you've never given much thought to the electrical system that powers your AC. Because why would you? Regional power grids bring electricity from the power plant somewhere nearby to our outlets. And you probably never think about any of this until the power goes out. Power outages occur more often during extreme weather events, like hurricanes, wildfire, and heat waves, each of which is happening more and more because of climate change, and often when people need power the most. Refrigerators and air conditioners don't just make life comfortable, they keep you safe. And the risk of power outages keeps increasing. It'd be nice to stay blissfully ignorant about power and just trust that there'll be electricity when we need it. But is that really wise? To figure out how power grids are planning ahead for increased demands and complications due to climate change, I spoke with my colleague, Julie McNamara, a senior energy analyst here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She explains the challenges that grid operators face in meeting our power needs and what methods we currently have for doing so. And spoiler alert, they're pretty inefficient. But our conversation goes to hopeful places, too, and I can guarantee that you'll be the star of your next dinner party with your new understanding of grid operation and electricity sourcing. Julie, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
I'm so glad to be here.
So I'm not sure how often the energy grid comes up in casual conversations with your friends, but I tell you that in my life, the number is zero. It's the poster child of out of sight, out of mind, but it's actually tremendously important. So can you describe the electricity grid in a way that the average person can kind of get a picture of how it works?
Sure. So the whole goal of the power grid is to get electricity from where it's generated
to the people who use it. That means getting from a power plant to that socket in your home. So we have these power plants, then transmission lines that bring power over often long distances, and then to smaller lines like you see around your neighborhood, which then eventually come to your home.
So are all grids equal, or are some better than others?
Sure. So the grid's been in a state of transition that we haven't seen in many, many decades. Moving from a model of these large centralized generators, these very massive power plants, to more distributed generation. And that means seeing wind farms and solar farms closer to your homes, on rooftops, all around the country. With that shift towards decentralized power, we actually increase the resilience of the grid because any single outage or fault on the system is less likely to cause a massive power event.
So who actually runs the grid day to day?
There are some parts of the country where utilities participate in markets, so they're sharing operations over broader regions. There are other parts of the country where utilities are very localized. And then within those different areas, there are also local power, municipal power, and co-ops.
So it's basically all over the place. You've got a whole range of different systems or ways of operating.
That's right. But there are still some core operating principles, and each region of the grid has to align with these. There's the National Electric Reliability Corporation and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission both set standards and check on the reliability of the grid. So a lot of operations have to meet such standards. And that comes into play when we get to especially some of these high-risk events and how to prepare for and prevent those.
So what's an example of a high-risk event?
Heat waves. So that's when you get to these situations where you're having increased demand on the grid at the same time that you have the increased chance of different pieces of equipment failing. And it's in those situations when you're facing these dueling challenges that you might lose power. And the whole goal is to keep power online 24/7, 365.
How robust is the system? I think most people think I flip my switch in my house and the electricity comes on. Is there reserve power just sitting, waiting for these moments of extreme heat?
Yeah, there are. And there are reserves at a lot of different levels, from, you know, minute by minute to day by day to seasons to on an annual basis. Because the way that the grid is planned is we use different amounts of power over the course of a day, over the course of a year, at different seasons, right? So in the middle of summer, you're running your air conditioning. In the fall, not so. So electricity load fluctuates. Grid planners are prepared for that. So they look at weather forecasts, for example, and they know how many resources they need to be prepared to have come online at a moment's notice. Some power plants are just ready and waiting right in the wings. Some take a little bit longer to call on. The newer resources we've been bringing online, things like solar, wind, and batteries, can actually respond very quickly to these types of things. In the past, we've relied, and still do, on natural gas power plants, which also some of these power plants can ramp up much faster than traditional coal or nuclear plants.
So basically, you're saying that there are plants that are just sitting at the ready. So if a heat wave is forecast, then they get up and running, they fire up and are ready to go?
That's right. So there are markets designed for this. A lot of this is based on a day-ahead market where there's a forecast for how much electricity will be needed. These power plants will bid in. And then real-time markets, which are really looking at if they underestimated or overestimated, making those minor adjustments day of. So especially in things like heat waves, there are some power plants that only run a few times a year. That's incredibly inefficient. It's really costly, right? You're keeping these big power plants around, sometimes small, just to be able to meet these peak events. But it's absolutely the case that the grid has historically been designed to serve customers. So to meet demand where it is, if you turn that switch, if you fire up that air conditioner, the grid is there to meet demand.
Let's talk a little bit about, with renewable energy now gaining momentum, how will solar, wind, battery power change the system?
So this system that we've historically used and relied upon is incredibly costly and inefficient. As I was saying, we're just keeping these power plants around to meet a few hours, a few days a year. As we pivot to these cleaner resources, especially things like solar plus storage, they can directly replace those natural gas peaker plants. Except not only can they meet those few hours a year, they can contribute year round, which means not only are they much more cost effective, they're also a lot cleaner. One of the challenges with peaker plants is that they're often located in communities. And on high heat days, there is very bad air quality, some of the worst air quality days of the year. And at that same time, you're powering up one whole class of these peaker plants are actually the equivalent of jet engines. So you're bolting a jet engine to the ground and you're firing it up right at these bad air quality days. That's a terrible mix. It's costly and it's bad for public health. So being able to replace those peaker plants with these clean resources that can benefit communities the whole year round, that's the better way to go.
And the definition of a peaker plant is this plant that just comes on at those times, those few times in the year when needed.
That's right. They're all targeting that peak period of the day.
Is being a grid operator a stressful job?
I have to imagine. you see these pictures of their operating rooms, and they've got screens all over the place. The power grid is the backbone of all our critical services, right? Everything relies on electricity when you follow that thread far enough back. So when the power goes out, it's a real crisis. So one of the most important things operators can do is not only ensure that, right, the power stays on, that's their number one goal, but they have these remote operation centers, right? They have their own resilience plans just to be sure that they're able to manage outages themselves.
As we're recording today, it's quite hot here in the Boston area.
That it is.
We're having another, I'm not sure it's going to qualify as a heat wave, but a few days of above 90 degree temperatures. How did the grid manage with our last couple of heat waves?
Overall, the grid did pretty well. In a heat wave, the grid is stressed from really two sides. There is the increased electricity use from all these additional air conditioners coming online, fans, refrigerators running harder. But then there's also the stress on the grid components themselves. And that hits every facet of the grid, starting with power plants, where these coal plants, nuclear, natural gas, that rely on water for cooling. When water gets warmer, they're less able to cool their systems. And in fact, we've seen in past events, when the water gets too warm, they have to shut down operations entirely. So that's taking some of your most important power plants and taking offline exactly when you need them most. Then you have these transmission lines, which those are the lines that convey electricity long distances. They are less efficient in high heat, so they can't carry as much electricity. They also run the risk of sagging as it gets warmer and more electricity comes through them. When they sag, they risk faulting. That can take a line off, then that can stop right the flow of electricity. And if the grid operators aren't carefully managing that situation, it can quickly spiral into a huge event. The 2003 Northeast blackout was an example of that, where just a single line eventually triggered a massive cascading outage event that got 50 million customers across the Northeast.
Right.
Of course, after the 2003 Northeast blackout, a lot of new standards and operating procedures were put in place that helped protect us from such a thing happening again.
So that raises another question for me. When something happens en route from power plant to my electric switch, do they know immediately what has happened and where it is?
They're getting better at it and better able to quickly reroute electricity so any given challenge with the grid doesn't take the whole thing down. And this is something that grid operators plan for. So it's not just, do we have enough power generators to meet peak electricity demand? But also, can we meet peak electricity demand if our largest power plant goes down, if a very important transmission line goes down? Can we still manage those outage events? And that's why we still have a lot more resources available than we actually expect to need.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. If you'd like a transcript or links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. So I'm currently doing a push to promote Got Science. So please tell your friends, colleagues, family, that kid selling lemonade on the side of the road about the episodes and topics you like. And if you have a sec, please leave us a review. It's quick and easy. When you open Got Science in your podcast app, scroll down to the bottom to ratings and reviews and leave a comment. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Now let's get back to our interview. So how do power grids maintain reliability in a heat wave?
So this is a multi-step process, starting from long-range planning that spans years out. That's looking at forecasts for how much electricity is anticipated to be on the system needed in those peak events and ensuring that there are enough power generators available to meet that. The power grid is a large interconnected machine, and it's running all the time, which means that it needs maintenance. There are parts that need to be replaced. So when it comes to infrastructure planning, ensuring that these fixes, if, say, a power plant needs to go down for a bit or if a transmission line needs to be replaced, doing that in what we call shoulder seasons, the spring and the fall when less electricity is needed, so there's more slack on the system. Then, though, there's still some maintenance events that require longer periods. So it's staggering those to ensure there aren't too many overlapping, which would preclude the ability to meet peak demand during summer. There's also the case that power equipment fails, right? And you can have these unexpected events, and making sure you have enough backup power in place, as well as planning for how to mitigate the effects of such an unexpected outage. Then there's forecasting. Weather forecasters are incredibly important to grid operators because they're the ones who say, well, we expect in a couple of days that the weather's going up. And then as that day approaches, that's projecting forecasted demand and then signaling how much electricity will be needed by generators. And then when the actual heat wave arrives, power operators are firing up peaker plants. They are bringing their least used resources online. They're also looking to neighboring regions, which may not also be suffering such high weather, to use electricity from them. And then they're calling on customers themselves to reduce usage. That can be in the form of demand response programs, where, say, an industrial customer doesn't actually need to be running all of their systems at that given time. Or that can be in programs where, say, big box stores turn off every other bank of light, or smart thermostats are turned up a degree or two, which, you know, for any given person, not a big change, but across the grid as a whole, makes a really big difference. So that's an incredibly important and effective solution.
So when they're planning, looking out a few years, are grid operators or managers taking into account climate change, or do they do their projections based on, you know, what has happened in the last 5 years?
It's often a retrospective. And one of the ways we've long run up against challenges in that is the fact that energy efficiency standards have been increasingly stringent and really making great strides in reducing electricity use. We've also begun decoupling our general economy from electricity use. So where utilities long planned for steadily increasing use, we've actually been long showing that that use has been dropping off, which all highlights the importance of thinking about all the different elements at play. Because now as we add electric vehicles to the system, as we anticipate changing climate conditions, that also needs to be factored in. Because on the same side as we anticipate extreme heat, there are areas where there will be less of a need for electricity use in the winter.
So, Julie, if I gave you a blank slate and said, here's a whole new system that you could develop, what are the first three things you would do?
So here's the thing. We don't have a blank slate available to us. And it's really important to reckon with the system that we have. With a blank slate, build a decentralized system where the infrastructure is planning for climate impacts from the start, where foresight is the name of the game, where renewables are integrated fully and completely, and the system is planning for that. But the system that we have today requires a different set of priorities because we have to begin from where we are and build from there.
So it sounds like it's like a patchwork.
It is. It is. And, you know, a lot of grid infrastructure is intended to last decades and decades, and it's expensive. And it's paid for by ratepayers, right? Your electricity bill, your natural gas bill. So every investment that we make has to be thoughtfully, intentionally built. That's not traditionally been the case. But the more that we know about climate impacts, the more we know we have to factor them in to all climate and to all infrastructure so that it's climate resilient, climate smart.
So, Julie, what got you hooked on the electricity grid?
Well, I think so much of the electricity grid is where the rubber meets the road for beginning our progress, furthering our progress on climate change. It's a complex system, but affects every facet of everyday life, and it's so important. And these decisions have long been made in closed room. It's very hard to influence the system. And one of the things that I think we really try to do here is ensure that these policies that will affect decisions and investments that will last many decades into the future are thoughtful, are considerate of changing circumstances, and are really are in the best interests of people and the environment.
The grid is overwhelming. Climate change is overwhelming. It's hard to feel like you can make any difference. Are there things that the average person can do?
At every step of the grid, there are challenges that we face and also opportunities that we can take advantage of. And I think especially when it comes to individuals, that comes down to how we use electricity. There are choices we can make, and then there are choices we do not have the power to make unless broader policies bring them online. And here I'm really thinking about, for example, the energy efficiency of air conditioning equipment. Air conditioners are widely used in the U.S., less widely used globally, but we know that with extreme heat rising from climate change, air conditioner use will be skyrocketing. The single most important thing we can do is make sure that there is a rapid and aggressive set of standards for lowering the energy use of air conditioning systems. That is so important because access to cooling isn't just a matter of comfort, it's health and safety, and it shouldn't be a choice. It shouldn't be up for debate whether people have access to cooling. It's critical. And so making sure that that huge deployment of air conditioners is efficient is so important. But again, that's not something that you or I can do. That's something that, say, in the U.S., that's federal standards that then trickle down to manufacturers and then show up in what options we face when we purchase this equipment ourselves. It's also a matter of pushing for policies that help break the cycle we're currently facing. As greenhouse gas emissions increase, the number of extreme heat days we see will rise. And it's also the case that the power sector is a large contributor of greenhouse gases. So we're working actively at the state level, at the federal level, at the local level, to try to push for more clean energy every day. This is something that everyone has a say in, right? This is building a grid for the future that we want. And so it's pushing for these policy choices that send us in that direction.
So I'm kind of jazzed about the grid now.
Excellent.
What do you think the best way to bring it up in a conversation, say, you know, I'm having a dinner party and a few friends over without killing the whole, you know, evening?
That's right. You know, I think there are a heck of a lot of great digi-knows, but I also worry that my dinner party invitations have been dwindling.
Oh, dear.
it's all about factoring all of those great. There is progress here. I think the challenges are actually really important to talk about because I think, you know, extreme heat is something that we all feel. And I know that when I'm out walking in this weather, I feel like I'm wilting, right? And yet you go into something like a grocery store and you feel that blast of cold air, and it's hard not to think about how much energy that must be using. And you see all these compressors cycling on, cycling off, building after building after building. This is a big challenge, and it's something that's increasing. So how do we tackle that? How do we think about not only do we ensure health and safety, but at the same time, we're bringing more renewables online, and we're creating a system that can manage it. So there's some neat things that we haven't talked about in terms of alleviating the pressure that air conditioners put on the system, right? So for example, rooftop solar is generating the most electricity, the most power during the middle of the day. As more rooftop solar comes online, we're actually pushing that peak demand lower and later. That eases the stress on the system. In fact, last year during the July 2018 heat wave, it was estimated that rooftop solar in New England over the course of about 7 days saved on the order of $20 million just in reduced power prices. So we're making progress. And then we think about these things like these really heavily polluting power plants that are extremely costly that end up trickling through into your power bill. Replacing that with solar and storage, with these clean energy solutions, that's exciting stuff. That's clean, that's better, that's more cost effective.
Well, Julie, thanks for joining me on the podcast, and I will gladly invite you to dinner at my house anytime to talk about the grid.
It was a pleasure.
And now it's time to lighten the mood with an uplifting science story. Today, we're bringing you the third installment of our segment called Science for the Win. Welcome our winning correspondent, Cynthia Duraco.
Thanks, Colleen. It's summer, and as I speak, thousands of tourists are either heading to or coming back from East Coast's vacation land, the magnificent state of Maine. When I say Maine, you might think about rocky beaches, lobsters, and Stephen King's small towns full of demonic children and possessed dogs. But it's time to update those associations to include bright sunshine, strong winds, and fresh, clean energy. That's because earlier this summer, Governor Janet Mills signed into law a suite of bills that will reduce carbon emissions, boost renewable energy, create jobs, and fight climate change. I spent a few of my formative years on a farm in rural Maine and still have friends and family members living up north, so I'm especially glad to be sharing this win. Beyond that, there's just something about it that's really special, and that's people power, the power of democracy. Without federal leadership on renewable energy and reducing carbon emissions, people who care about climate change have focused on making progress state by state. If you're a UCS supporter or a longtime listener, you already know that. It's the will of the people in the United States that we act on climate change, including in Maine, where polls show that the majority of residents agree on increasing clean energy and decreasing emissions. In the state legislature, there's been bipartisan support for both. But for 8 years, the will of the people was blocked. The former governor opposed investments in clean energy and attempts to scale down emissions for mostly ideological reasons, and shut down bill after bill that would have taken steps to address the climate crisis locally. It seemed like there was no hope for Maine, despite an informed and eager populace and state lawmakers who were on board. When you have a leader who repeatedly stands in the way of your progress, you know what they say, you just can't get there from here. But that's the great thing about living in a democracy. When a new pro-clean energy governor was elected in 2018, my colleagues at UCS, working with a diverse coalition of folks, were ready to help guide and advocate for legislation to help Maine regain its national leadership in the fight against climate change. I might just move back. Here's what these new laws are going to achieve. Maine's renewable portfolio standard, the legal minimum for renewable energy sources in its energy mix, is going to double, from 40% by 2017 to 80% by 2030. That's the most ambitious target for 2030 in the United States. Next, markets for solar energy will be opened up to all Mainers. That's businesses, homeowners, and even renters, with new policies that remove restrictions on solar access. And finally, a committee has been created to keep Maine on track to reduce its global warming emissions to 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. The benefits of these policies also include improved public health, more jobs, less reliance on imported fossil fuels, and yeah, bragging rights. And there's one more thing that makes this win really special, and that's the swiftness of this progress. For 8 long years, many Mainers were stuck and frustrated by their leadership's inaction on climate change. But with just one election, in 6 months, from the governor's inauguration to the signing of these bills, Maine has gone from falling behind to leading the way. And that's the way life should be. Great job, Maine. We're wicked proud of you. I'm Cynthia Duraco, and this has been Science for the Win.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our Partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Julie McNamara. Science for the Win by Cynthia Duraco. Editing and music by Brian Middleton. Additional editing by Omari Spears. Research and writing by Pamela Wirth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen McDonald. Come find us on Twitter at GotScienceUCS. Thanks, and see you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:58. Coming up next at 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. But first, this from KBOO Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Events Committee meets the third Tuesday of each month at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bound, Africans vs. African Americans movie screening and discussion, on Saturday, August 24th at 2 p.m. at the Central Library in Portland. The movie will be followed by a panel discussion about the Black diaspora. Again, that's Bound, Africans vs. African Americans movie screening and discussion, on Saturday, August 24th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Central Library, 801 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're tuned in to community-supported KBOO Community Radio. Coming up next at 10 is Flashpoints with Dennis Burns.